Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning with the interview that you have already heard a couple of excerpts from during Morning Edition today, the interview which I was privileged to record on Friday with U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan. Because Speaker Ryan's air flight from Washington back to Wisconsin was delayed by about 20 minutes, our conversation had to be a little bit shorter than was originally planned. Nevertheless, I do appreciate him still fitting us into a very, very busy schedule to have this conversation. In part two of today's program, we're going to be hearing from W. Hodding Carter and the inspiring story of his attempt to qualify for the Olympics in swimming at the ripe old age of 44. That's coming up a little later in this hour of the Morning Show here on WGTD. I am privileged indeed to have a few precious minutes with U.S. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. And Speaker Ryan, I can't think of a more auspicious day in which to be speaking to you with such dramatic events unfolding over the last couple of days. Let's begin, and we will get to the Better Way, a Vision for a Confident America in just a moment. But let's talk first about the dramatic events in Britain with the public's vote there to leave the European Union, and markets, of course, around the world responding very negatively to this move. How do you greet this vote by the British public? Do you see it as a positive for Britain and for the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's going to settle down. I believe that it was a bit of a surprise and a shock to the global financial system, and therefore you're seeing this kind of reaction. That reaction is not surprising to me. I do believe that the reaction will be processed and things should settle down. That's point number one. Point number two, I can't say I'm surprised because people want self-government. They want sovereignty. They want self-determination. And I can't say that I would feel differently if I were a citizen of Great Britain when you have people from other countries regulating your country, writing your laws. It's so foreign for us as Americans to even think about the concept that somebody or some official in Brussels, in another country, would be, writing our laws, changing our sovereignty. So as an American, it's so foreign. We believe in sovereignty, self-government, government by consent. So I can clearly relate to the thinking behind the Brexit vote, behind leave. But having said that, what it's important for us as Americans, at least as an official, as myself, is to show solidarity with the people of Great Britain, to demonstrate that they're still our ally, our indispensable ally, our special relationship is intact, so that we can continue to have a peaceful landing here, a smooth landing, so that we can sort of settle down the jittery markets, because we don't want to see economic turmoil as a result of this.
Right. Speaking of turmoil, of course, some of the Democrats of the House of Representatives, of course, created a bit of that with their unprecedented demonstration. Two quick questions about that. First of all, did you have any inkling that that was going to happen? I'm not assuming that they would have forewarned you of such a gesture, but did you have some sense that something, anything like that was going to occur?
Yeah, we got about maybe an hour heads up, and they said that they were hoping to get arrested and hauled off the floor. They told a number of my staff that. And so I did get a brief heads up about it. Now, mind you, they were breaking the rules and shutting Congress down. We were in the middle of considering our response to the Zika virus, which is very timely and important. This is something that's got to be dealt with quickly. And they shut down the rules over a bill that was voted on and defeated in the Senate, a bill that was voted on as an amendment to the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill in the House and defeated on a bipartisan basis. So there is a way to bring legislation to the floor, to consider legislation, and they chose not to pursue that. They chose to try and shut the place down. This is why I called it a publicity stunt. It was voted on in committee. It was voted on in the Senate. There is another way to bring a bill straight to the floor if they wanted to choose that way. They chose not to. Instead, they did this. And then all the while they were doing this, they were soliciting fundraising dollars, political fundraising, to bring attention to their publicity stunt to raise money. And I thought that was shameful. I thought that was wrong to stop the democracy, our seat of democracy from functioning and working and doing the people's business.
I wonder what you think about your working relationship with House Democrats, given this move on their part. Do you feel like that working relationship has been irreparably damaged by this? How do you see yourself moving forward from here?
The feeling I simply have is one of disappointment. I'm disappointed that my colleagues believe that they could do this to our institution that we all care about. We believe in having a civil, democratic process, a deliberative process where we civilly and calmly debate ideas, discuss and vote. And I'm disappointed that they chose to upend that and to descend it into chaos. I'm disappointed that they chose that route because the very issue they were calling for was being considered in one of our committees. It had been voted on already in the Senate. They just didn't like the way the vote turned out. But that's democracy. That's how majorities work. So if you don't like the outcome, you go and shut the entire system down. I think that that is something that disrespects democracy, the rule of law, the decorum of the House of Representatives. But more importantly, I guess the emotion I really have is just one of disappointment.
So how do you move on from here in terms of trying to work with the Democrats to repair any damage that you see having been done to the institution?
I think that may be up to them, how they want to conduct themselves going forward. We made sure that we didn't let it stop us from doing our jobs. As I mentioned, the Zika virus, we have 425 pregnant women who already are infected with Zika in America. And so we need to find a vaccine. We need to get the resources to the Centers for Disease Control. And this is something that we had prioritized to get done this week. And I was not going to let the House be shut down so we couldn't consider these issues. So we powered ahead and moved forward anyway, despite the camping and the shouting and the screaming, and got our work done on behalf of the people we represent.
Let's go on to what I know is a high priority for you, albeit something perhaps crowded a bit off the center stage by some of these other events, namely this Republican plan of action called A Better Way, Our Vision for a Confident America. What are the most important hallmarks of this plan that you want the American people to know about?
Well, number one, this was my number one priority on becoming speaker. I wanted to make sure that we in the majority in the House, the Republicans, don't just oppose, but we propose, that we can't just be an opposition party. We have to be a proposition party. And so I set forth with my colleagues all year long to work on finding solutions to the big problems facing Americans today so that for the people who think America is headed in the wrong direction, which is 7 out of 10 Americans, we need to show a better way forward. We need to show an alternative path. We need to give people a choice. Give them a path to fixing our problems. It has 6 main components. Number one, we need to do a better job of getting people out of poverty. There are people stuck in persistent poverty, and our programs to address it are not working. We need to move people from welfare to work, and so that's number one. We have a strong plank, a plan, a game plan, a reform plan to get people out of poverty. Number two, foreign policy and security, terrorism. These are big problems, and we don't think the policy by the administration is working. So we offered a 67-point plan on how to keep us safe, how to combat terrorism, how to address homegrown jihad like we saw in Orlando, how to secure our border and fix our military. Number three, the regulatory state. Regulations are just crushing small businesses. They're keeping our economy down. They're hurting wages. So we wanted a regulatory reform platform. Number four, how do you restore self-government? There's this new branch of government, the fourth branch of government, which is effectively unelected bureaucrats writing our laws, the rules and regulations. And as people, we're basically losing the power of self-government, where the laws that we live under, they're supposed to be written by our elected representatives that we duly elect in Congress. Well, that's not the case as much anymore these days. Unelected bureaucrats are writing the laws we're living under, and that means we're losing accountability in our government. So we want government to be more accountable. We want more of a self-determining system where we have government by consent. Number five, everybody knows we're against Obamacare. We need to show what we would replace it with. What's a better system that can actually lower healthcare costs, lower healthcare premiums, give people more choices, and make sure that we still have good protections for people with pre-existing conditions? We did that. We rolled out a plan for that. And then today, we rolled out a plan to overhaul our tax code. Lower tax rates for families and small businesses. Make the code simpler. You can fit the code on a postcard. The tax form that Americans will fill out under our plan is a postcard-sized plan because we get rid of the Washington special interest carve-outs, the special interest deals that crank up taxes and put favoritism in the tax code. So we get rid of all of that, dramatically lower our taxes on businesses so they can provide more jobs. We allow businesses to write off their investment in plant and equipment so they can hire more people. And we dramatically overhaul the Internal Revenue Service so that it's more of a service-oriented agency and not the one that we have today. So that agenda at better.gop is designed to fix our country's big problems. How do we get us? How do we get our debt under control? How do we grow our economy? How do we keep us safe? How do we have faster wage growth? American leadership. How do we make sure government's more accountable? How do we get people out of poverty? These are a lot of the big issues that we think we need to confront, and we're offering this agenda so that we can earn the right to put it in place in 2017.
One phrase that jumps out again and again as we read through what you've released is the phrase, we have to raise our gaze, G-A-Z-E. What's meant
right.
by that? Where is our gaze right now, and why does it have to be raised? In what way?
I think both Republicans and Democrats, independents, and everyone in between, it's high anxiety in America. We're not talking about the horizon we want to go to collectively as a country. We're squabbling. We're fighting. It's divisive. And I think we need to raise our gaze as a country and as people to go and work together to solve our problems. And what we're trying to do is offer an agenda that is meant to include and inspire. It's meant to be inclusive. It's meant to be aspirational. We are an optimistic people with a great country that can be even better. And that horizon is something we should shoot for. And that's what I mean when I say raise our gaze. Let's come up with a plan, which is what we're doing here, to actually fix America's big problems so that people can get opportunity, so that people can have a better life.
30
seconds.
What we're
going to do is take our principles, improve, offer solutions to improve people's lives. That's basically what I mean.
30 seconds. July 18th is the start of the Republican presidential convention. What are your highest hopes for what's going to happen there? What are your highest priorities?
You know, I haven't even given it a thought. It's a good question. I'm the chair of it. I just want it to go smoothly, and I want to make sure that everyone follows the rules and it's done very transparently, and that we have a good convention.
As I say goodbye, I want to thank you as a member of the faculty at Carthage College for the commencement speech which you delivered at Carthage. It was exciting to have you there, and certainly exciting to have you now on the morning show today. U.S. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, thank you so much for your time. Best wishes.
Great. My pleasure, Greg. Thanks so much. Take care.
The time is 8:23. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Perhaps you took a little time this weekend, as I did, to watch some of the U.S. Olympic trials, specifically in the sports of gymnastics and diving. It brought to mind, as I watched the trials, an interview which I did back in 2008 with a talented writer by the name of W. Hodding Carter, the author of a number of intriguing books, including Stolen Water, Saving the Everglades from Its Friends, Foes, and Florida, and more recently, Flushed, How the Plumber Saved Civilization, a book about how what we think of as modern plumbing made a huge difference in the advancement of civilization. The occasion on which I spoke with Mr. Carter back in 2008 was because of a memoir he wrote called Off the Deep End, the probably insane idea that I could swim my way through a midlife crisis and qualify for the Olympics. W. Hodding Carter was a very, very talented collegiate swimmer who just missed the Olympics back in his youthful prime. He decided at the age of 42 to make an unlikely attempt at qualifying for the 2008 Beijing Olympics. It was an effort which was ultimately unsuccessful, but W. Hodding Carter made surprising advances and very nearly achieved his goal. At this point in the interview, he is recounting about some of his early successes, which actually got him a bit overconfident. He was not fully honest about the progress that he was making and, in a sense, getting way ahead of himself.
This is what you say in kind of describing how good these initial few times were in the pool. You said, there I was feeling quite pleased with myself. In less time than it would have taken me when I was in my supposed prime, I'd not only returned to racing form, but was about to exceed all expectations. Did they still put athletes on Wheaties boxes, or should I just try for one of those Gap print ads, I wondered? Could I be a pro and swim at the Olympics? If I'd been honest with myself, I would have realized that the fact that I'd done only two 50s and had rested a few minutes between each one meant that they weren't true indicators of my pace. If I'd been honest with myself, I would have swum four of them with only 10 seconds rest between each. Or I might have taken note of the fact that I was completely winded after each 50 and that my jaw ached from the lactic acid etching its way through my muscles, all of which should have been signs. But I wasn't seeing signs that day. I mean, that is the universal warning here. I mean, it isn't just if someone's trying to go after the Olympics in their mid-40s, but for any of us trying to do anything, we have to be honest enough with ourselves to see the signs.
It's really funny, is that, you know, when you're reading that, I was like, my face was turning red, I was hiding, and because, you know, that's totally me at that time. I mean, I was just fooling myself, and I really believed, instantly that I was ready, and that just after 2 months I was going to be like this phenom, you know, and that the whole world was going to be amazed at. And, you know, and I definitely poked fun of myself, you know, right there in the beginning of the book. But, you know, when I look at it from right now, when you read that, I realize that that's also what kept me going, you know, that sort of fooling myself as in the beginning, and I think even all along, I mean, throughout the book, there's like moments like that, I think, because if I didn't do that, then I would see like how far I had to go, and I think I would have quit, you know.
Well, sure.
For good,
well,
you know?
And in fact, you describe yourself, I think, as back when you first started swimming competitively, and all the way up to more like the present day, you describe yourself as a weak kid with a strong imagination. I mean, in a sense, if you hadn't had that strong imagination that could picture yourself on a Wheaties box, that was an essential element in making all of this possible. I mean, the successes you had as a collegiate athlete and also made very real this possibility that you could accomplish all of this again. That imagination was important. It just couldn't be the only thing you had going for you.
Right, exactly. I was right. I think I was counting more on that than I should have without even realizing it. But, you know, it's funny. Yeah, it's gotten me to this level now where, you know, I went from, as I described, you know, total failure in the first race, crawling out of the pool on my hands and knees, to this past winter, I was number two in the world for my age group in a couple of races, and I had beaten my best time in college for the 50 freestyle, you know, the shortest sprint race there is. So, you know, I luckily was able to sort of catch up with my imagination eventually, I think. But it's sort of incredible to me how much, like, that is necessary for – Maybe it's a younger athlete too, but I think for an older athlete, you have to just go with your fantasy, go with your dreams in a way, and with your a little bit of fooling yourself, just to make sure you keep going, because there's so much in society telling you not to do something like this, that it's impossible, that, you know, you're nowhere near the level you need to be, or this, you just can't do it because you're too old, or any of those things. And I think you have to rely on something coming from inside yourself telling you, no, you're doing this. Keep going, buddy. You know, and especially because a lot of people I'm competing against never quit swimming. They've been, you know, the ones who are like the really – turns out there are a lot of great master swimmers, which is another thing I didn't realize when I first started back. And, you know, they've never really stopped. And so for me to catch up with them, I think I had to put myself in a sort of fantasy land so that I could see achievement when it wasn't there, or success, so that that's because for me, that's what helps keep me going. It's a little bit of success, like, then I'll go, okay, it's worth it. I'll keep going.
Right. You also talk about how when you finally had that breakthrough in college and really scored some tremendous successes, that you had decided once and for all, kind of in the wake of this breakup with your girlfriend and returning to the team, and just having to give swimming your all in a way that you never had before, that you had that incredible joy of experiencing what that was like. You said, "I love the feeling of no longer having any excuses, knowing that I was giving something my all without my being fully aware. It was a little bit scary even, and so I naturally grew closer to those people going through the same experience. These days, there's only one thing that I habitually miss in my life, and it's those days, those fellow swimmers, and that particular feeling of unrestrained effort." I love those last words, and whether somebody's trying to be a champion-level swimmer or to be a concert pianist virtuoso or whatever the venture is at hand, the joy of unrestrained effort is something we don't always fully appreciate.
Well, Greg, yeah, I mean, I look at my life, I look at my friends, I look at everyone, and this includes I'm including myself in this, but, you know, once you get through those early years, you know, you're out of college and maybe even the first few years afterwards, most of us don't do anything at that level anymore, because I think life sort of like, when you try that, normally you fail, you know, and like the more failure you have, the more hesitant you get at attempting something, you know, with unrestrained effort. And I think that's a big, now, you know, having put like a full amount of effort into this project, I think that's a big mistake. Because even though I didn't make it to the Olympics this time around, my real goals, the things I wanted inside for myself have been met, you know, and it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't done this. I mean, the thing that I really want more in life, more than anything, is to have this family in which, you know, this picture I have is of us all sort of smiling and together and just, you know, a happy family. I mean, I write about this in the book because I didn't realize this until I totally immersed myself in the project. But that's what I want. And by going after this crazy swimming dream, I ended up getting that. And it was in a roundabout way. But you know, it wouldn't have, I don't know, I don't think it would have happened otherwise. And so I hope that, like, in at least in some ways, in my book, you know, shows that you can still go after something all the way, and there is a reward. It may not be the thing you think it's going to be, but there is a great reward for doing so.
We're speaking with W. Hodden Carter about his book, Off the Deep End. I need to ask you about the top of the subtitle of this book, the probably insane idea that I could swim my way through a midlife crisis. Talk for a moment about, to whatever extent you were experiencing at this point in your life, the classic sort of midlife crisis. I mean, and the ways in which maybe that it was different from that we often hear about, or was this a fairly typical sort of midlife crisis that so many people experience?
Well, I think there's two answers. One is, I think I've throughout my whole life I've had midlife crises. You know, I think I've had multiple midlife crises. In some ways I go off in a really different direction, always questioning what I've been doing the last few years and wondering if that's where I want to be, and then heading off somewhere else. I mean, it's always, I've taken writing with me the whole time, so that's been the work I've done. But, you know, I've really immersed myself into different areas. And so in one way, that's dishonest, because this isn't my only midlife crisis. But then another way, I think it's really true. And I'm not, you know, there's some, Entertainment Weekly wouldn't review this book because it had the word midlife crisis in the title, the subtitle. Right. And which is just so insane to me, because like, there's such this fear of being an older person in our society now, you know, and presenting that as if it could be anything but horrible, when, you know, the majority of us are over 40 in this country, you know, I think that figure is correct. And we're going to be, you know, if we're lucky enough, you know. And so it's just, I don't know, I don't even get that. But anyway, I was at a crossroads for sure, because I had spent our way into total danger of our family, because I kept thinking my next book was going to be a bestseller. And so I said to my wife, oh, you know, we can do this renovation. Oh, no, we can go on this vacation. Oh, no, we can do all these things, but my next book's going to make it. And, you know, and she didn't really buy into it, but she had to go along because, she, you know, we were together. And we got hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt in our house, more than we should have gotten even. And that was one element. And the other was actually because of that, you know, Lisa, my wife, wanted to, you know, divorce me, wanted to at least get separated. And we did. When I first started back swimming, actually, we got separated. And it wasn't because a lot of people read the book and they say, oh, the swimming drove your wife so crazy, she broke up with you. But no, actually, everything up till that point had driven her crazy. You know, all the action of just, you know, believing that something, you know, that then around the next corner was going to, you know, be the big payoff, you know, is what did it. And then coming back into swimming itself, actually, and sort of grounding myself in swimming actually helped get us back together.
Hmm. You describe swimming and what it gave you emotionally, I think, so well when you say, I've always associated swimming with freedom and joy and youth. I love swimming, the feel of the water swirling past my body, the different forces exerted on the palm of my hand as I stroke through the water, the gentleness of being buoyant. Swimming had been my constant companion from adolescence on. In short, being a swimmer was how I defined myself for more than half my life. I missed swimming, plain and simple. What's interesting is that I think when a lot of us think about competitive swimming, we don't think about words like freedom and joy. I mean, we think about endless hours, backbreaking hours, and in a sense, the tedium that seems to be a part of seriously training for this sport.
I think that's why a lot of swimmers, by the time when they finish their last year of college or they swim at the Olympics and they, you know, they're done with it, because there is a certain amount of tedium to it. You just see that black line back and forth. But, you know, the whole reason why I stayed with swimming and got into it was because of what you read out loud, though, because that's what it is when I'm not, you know, being forced, you know, by a coach to do those laps, or I'm not just focused on a goal. You know, the water just presents, you know, this escape from my everyday life. And I'd forgotten that either through all those years of really hard swimming, you know, for a team, or just forgotten it because I grew older and I hadn't been swimming anymore. And so it was when I got back in with my kids is what really reminded me of that. And I feel really, like, lucky or blessed that I rediscovered it, that because of wanting to get my kids to swim, you know, it brought me back to that.
Hmm. As you redoubled your efforts to in 2005, one of the things you said, I think you say this so well, is, I felt I needed a few more eyes on the situation. That is, you needed skilled eyes looking at you as you swam. And offering you suggestions on ways in which you could be training more effectively and perfecting your technique, or maybe changing your technique altogether. Tell us about the race club and some of the help which you were given, and just what that experience was like as you attempted to take this up another level.
It's funny because I think, you know, looking back, I could see that I needed a few more eyes. But even at the time, even when I decided to go to the race club, I think I was still filled with so much hubris that I didn't really believe I needed the help. I just thought, oh, yeah, going to camp would be a good way to get some extra swimming in. But luckily, I did go down there. And John Olson, who was an Olympic 100 freestyler and a great relay swimmer for our country, was the coach for Gary Hall, junior, back when I went to this camp. And it was Gary Hall's camp. But I got really lucky the week I decided to go to camp, because his dad, Gary Hall Sr., who was a three-time Olympian and one of my heroes when I was a kid, was doing the camp at the same time. And it was just, you know, beyond my dreams, you know, getting to be coached, you know, one-on-one pretty much. There was only one other camper. by an Olympic, you know, swimmer and coach, and then to be swimming next to an Olympian while doing that, you know, it was unbelievable. And they were telling me things that I didn't quite hear at the time. I couldn't quite figure out. But within about a year or two later, about a year later, I caught on to, and which has brought my swimming to a whole nother level and sort of opened me up to the idea of, okay, I don't know it all. And it's just, it was sort of a turning point in all of my training, because I, up to that point, I'd been thinking, oh, I have to do 10,000 yards a day, and I have to swim just like I did in college, and I have to do this and do that. But the truth was I needed to swim like a guy in his 40s, and I had to really focus on technique. And by going to this camp and by listening to other people, I finally realized that. And these days I'm training about half as much as I was doing 4 years ago, or maybe a third less even. And I'm going, you know, a second faster in a 22-second race. And it's all, I believe, from going to that camp and from, you know, just listening for once and having other people actually help me with my swimming. You know, it's not a sole enterprise.
Right. One of their tenets, which really makes a lot of sense, is that so much Gary Hall particularly challenged what was the prevailing thinking of the U.S. swimming organizations, that all swimmers needed to be trained in the traditional endurance-based world. You said, we were training all of our swimmers from age 6 on up to be endurance athletes, and that this approach excluded kids who were fast-twitch athletes. In other words, in too many places, we train all of our swimmers as though they're all going to be marathoners,
right,
when some of them are destined by who they are and the way they're built, I suppose, to be sprinters.
He's not going to get the credit for this. I mean, I don't think Gary Hall Jr. will, but he was writing this and yelling and screaming about this for the last, you know, I don't know how many years, because he's definitely one of those people who needs to train that way. But in truth, almost all our swimmers needed to switch over to more quality-based training, because for the last 40 years almost, we've been doing the same type of training, which is just way, way overburdening the system, doing, you know, lap after lap just to build a 90% endurance base, and then just a little bit of 10% speed training. And now I've noticed, I was listening to people and talking to them about what workouts these Olympic swimmers are doing now, and they've cut back on their yardage by probably, you know, a good half of amount of yardage of what Olympic swimmers used to do in a day. And so I think the people are coming around, and the results this year indicate, you know, that this is the better training. It wasn't just the swimsuits this time around. I think it was a change in training that probably helped us more than anything.
One of the most interesting chapters in your book is about your encounter with another famous swimmer, once upon a time the most famous swimmer in the world, Mark Spitz, who, of course, attempted something not terribly unlike this attempt that you made. And you met him and wrote about this. Just talk for a moment about the way in which your path and Mark Spitz's path crossed, and the sort of difficult feelings with which you are wrestling to this very day.
Well, the thing is, when I was a kid, Mark Spitz, you know, like for so many other people, people aren't even swimmers, you know, he was my hero. I mean, he was, you know, the god. I bowed down to his poster. My sister, you know, I got his gold medal poster, you know, with the 7 gold medals and the Olympic swim team, you know, suit. And I was, you know, knew one day I would be him, and I always dreamed of swimming with him. Well, when I was an adult and I hadn't swum for about, you know, 8 years competitively or so, I had a chance to swim with him because he made a comeback in his 40s, and I was working at Esquire magazine, and I really wanted to write for them, and there was this chance I could swim with Mark Spitz and write an article because it's something I knew about. So they sent me out, and I swam with him, and I at first wrote a pretty nice piece about him, like, you know, but my editor was like, this isn't the real Mark Spitz we all know, because he's a jerk. And I'm like, what? And I went back and read all this material on him. I was like, oh, he was really obnoxious when he was younger. But, you know, that didn't really have anything to do with him now. But anyway, I looked at more like what he was doing and how he was training this comeback. And I ended up writing this really obnoxious piece about it, which to this day I'm embarrassed about. not so much because I was totally wrong, but because I think I didn't give him a chance. Part of me didn't give him a chance because he was in his 40s, you know, and I was this younger guy, and I thought, well, you know, this is idiotic. You can't do this in your 40s. And so, you know, I was just, like, as brainwashed and as ignorant, I think, as anyone else. And so I spent a good half of that one chapter in my book, I think, hopefully I made it seem like, you know, being apologetic to Mark for having mocked him when he made his comeback attempt.
In one, you essentially said in your article that it seemed like he might have been going after this for all the wrong reasons, basically going after it for some money and some glory and some fame. And now you realize that there's also the very real possibility that he was doing it for more serious, profound, personal reasons. You posed the question, what if his real reason was because he truly thought he could make it and he didn't want to grow old, not having tried? And, of course, you, in the middle of a similar attempt, realize now, more than you did then, that was not something to make fun of at all.
It definitely, it's all a matter of perspective, I guess. When I was finally in his shoes, I could see. No, you know, it's funny. I wish I could have seen that when I was younger, you know, and that's why, you know, I'm hoping, like, you know, when you write something like this and maybe you see, have other people look at it and so they don't end up making the same mistake I did, because it almost doesn't really matter if 90% of the reason why is because he wanted to do it for the fame and the glory. It's just that he was still trying. He still put it out there and still was attempting this incredibly difficult thing, you know, in his 40s. And especially in the face of, you know, criticism like mine and all these other people. So it was a good lesson learned for me to having done that and then having put myself in the same shoes.
It really was fascinating to read this whole chapter where you are back at your alma mater of Kenyon College, training with some of these young current collegians and trying to rekindle some of the magic which had led you to be an all-American swimmer quarter of a century earlier. As someone who spends a fair amount of time now in a local health club, I remember being so reluctant, you know, afraid that I'd have kind of American gladiator types on either side of me, and relieved that, in fact, it's a nice, wider range of all kinds of different people. But, of course, my nightmare really was played out by you. I mean, you are back training with a team in which, I mean, everybody is absolutely at their youthful sort of physical prime. Just take us inside what that was like and how you were able in the end actually to pull something incredibly positive and helpful out of what had to in the beginning be a really tough situation.
I mean, at first I thought it was a funny idea, and the people in the alumni office were like, yeah, come back and pretend like you're a student and, you know, you can swim and stay in the dorm and go to classes. I mean, I was, after just 4 hours back at school, I was ready to quit and go home. It killed me. I mean, there was just way too much vigor and testosterone in the locker room. And the girls in the practice, you know, were young women, you know, they were beating me. You know, the slowest swimmers were beating me, you know. And so it was very humbling. And it was hard to figure out why I was there, you know, after that very first day. But it was also, I mean, there's so many things that made it worthwhile, because it made me realize how far I had to go. You know, that was really one of the most important things about it. And the second thing, though, is my coach, this guy who, when I was in college, you know, 25 years ago, really intimidated me, and I never really knew how much he was really on my side, even though he's the one who spurred me on to actually becoming a really fast swimmer my senior year. I wasn't ever too sure, but after I came back for this 1 week, you know, in the midst of my retraining, you know, when I was 40, I think I was 44 at this point, he was the one who has kept me going the last few years. So he said, no, Hodding, I believe you can do this. You know, after he watched me swim, and he said, you can swim faster than you ever swam. And so it was sort of like, I don't know, it was giving me my second wind by going back there. But it certainly didn't feel that way in the beginning.
Right. One of the things you said is that when you were back at Kenyon as a student, certainly you and a lot of your teammates who are part of the swimming program, and it was a good swimming program, really didn't lift weights a whole lot. And you said that even after a year of rather industriously lifting weights, you all looked like bookworms at best. And as you looked around you as at the imposing specimens of the current Kenyan swim team, it's clear that there and probably in other places too, a lot has changed about what is expected of a young collegiate athlete and their body.
And especially like a young collegiate swimmer. I mean, because like you said, yeah, I mean, people were barely lifting weights back 25 years ago when they were doing swimming, and even on the Division I level. And I heard someone comment about the swimmers at the Olympics and how looking at their bodies, they thought, oh, they must be taking steroids or whatever. And, you know, it's insane. These are those young people who are actually just working out hard. And it's, but they are, you know, in comparison to how swimmers looked 30 years ago, I can see how some people might think that. But I can attest the reason why their bodies are like that. They're lifting weights like the way football players did 30 years ago. I mean, the routine that I went through with these kids, you know, was one of those things that on the first day that all again made me, you know, cry for my mama or my wife or whatever, and made me want to go home because it was a really hard weightlifting routine. But it turned out it wasn't something that was impossible for a 45 year old to do. I was able to. By the end of the week, I got the routine down, and it's what I've been doing ever since.
One of the things that ended up being a tremendously important breakthrough was when you started realizing exactly how you should work, and the fact that given the event that you were going to go after, one of the shortest of the sprints, that you could train in such a way that it would much more likely lead to a positive result without killing you in the process. You learned that I would have to try harder in practice, but for much shorter periods, like, say, 10 seconds versus 10 minutes. Talk a little more about this breakthrough and just how important it was in your efforts.
Well, I grew up like most, you know, American swimmers, at least, with this concept and this idea that, you know, more was better. And, you know, we would, if you could swim 5 miles a day, then the next year you should try to shoot for 6 miles a day. And, you know, I had some summers and some years where I was swimming literally 10 miles a day. And so that was what was in my head when I first started back swimming. I was thinking that's the thing to do. But the first couple of years back, you know, I had my yardage way up to about 7,000 yards a day, you know, four to 5 miles of swimming a day, but I wasn't getting any faster. And it was when I went back to the race club, they sort of tried to indoctrinate me with this idea of, you know, less was more and that, you know, quality was more important than quantity. I didn't quite catch on then, but then when I went back and I talked to my coach and, you know, looked at what their sprinters were doing and then worked, talked with a few other, you know, older swimmers who were swimming fast, and I, you know, finally put it together that, no, what I need to do is get in there and do some like weightlifting in the pool, essentially. I had to go all out sprints and do it, sort of repeats of that, but with lots of rest, just to get stronger and work on technique. Those are the two things that matter more, not going lots of miles. And so I've gotten it down now where I swim with a parachute behind me, and I pull it behind me, and I strap on paddles, and it's like, you know, essentially it's weightlifting while doing swimming. And you see sprinters on land do this as well, and so of course it will work in the pool. And that's, I think, one of the things that's really helped me drop my times dramatically was actually switching over to a training more like a runner sprinter than the old style swimming sprinter. And a lot of swimmers are starting to do that now, younger ones as well.
One of the best stories in the book is of when you decided to compete in a meet in March of the next year, and this was a meet in which it was not just a masters or grandmaster sort of thing, but where you would be competing against much younger swimmers. And you kind of tell the story, first of all, of being acutely self-conscious of the fact that you were walking around in one of those skimpy Speedos while almost all of your younger competitors were wearing, you know, different kind of swimsuits called jammers that actually have a lot more to them.
Right.
You say, here was the difference between being a 25-year-old Olympic hopeful and a 45-year-old Olympic wannabe. The 25-year-old strips down to his suit and feels lost in the crowd. Every time I took off my shorts, I felt like the 1,000 parents in the stands and all their children milling around the Bowdoin College pool deck were staring at me. It was worse than one of those caught in your underwear in high school dreams. Eventually, I took to wearing my jeans and T-shirt until I was just behind the block, and then right before they called my heat, I slipped out of my clothes quickly like an eager virgin. I mean, it's interesting to imagine what it would feel like, given that kind of self-consciousness, for you to be able to swim well, which you actually managed to do.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of look back at some of those meets now and wonder, you know, how I was able to do it. I don't swim as many of those ones because it really was intimidating. Not because, you know, those kids were beating me. Actually, you know, normally a lot of them, I'd be the fastest swimmer. I'd be one of the top three or four. But it was just because I felt so self-conscious. You know, I kept hoping they would think that it was a typo, my age, you know, in the program. And so sometimes I'd even wear, like, a robe, like, with a hood on it, you know, sort of hide my face and then, you know, even wear all that up to the block. And I knew, though, that my cover was blown because after a couple of races, you know, these 14- and 15-year-old boys or 18-, 19-year-old, depending on what meet it was, would come up to me and shake my hand after and say, it was a pleasure to race against you, Mr. Carter, an honor to race against you, Mr. Carter, which wasn't happening to the other swimmers, I can
right.
guarantee you.
Well, and it felt good, but probably made you feel rather ancient. But it's really around this time you start to realize that you are swimming faster and faster, getting very close to some of the best times you've ever posted in your entire career. So at last, all of these efforts begin to pay off in really spectacular fashion.
Yeah, it really did start to gel, I guess. As you know, I thought it was going to happen instantly, you know, just because I always sort of fooled myself into thinking things are going to work out right off, because otherwise I don't know if I would have jumped in. But, you know, it took, you know, almost 3 or 4 years for it to really come back to me and for, you know, the new type of training to work. But, you know, until up last December, December of 2007, I actually swam a time that, when converted, is equal to or better than my best time ever in the 50 freestyle. And I also started training, having these test sets in practice that would beat my old test sets from college by a few seconds even in the 100. A 47-second race or 46-second race, I was beating my test set times by a couple of seconds, you know, again and again. And so last spring, it really looked like I was going to make the qualifying time for the trials, which, you know, I'd always hoped and, you know, part of me believed I was going to do it, but there was obviously a part of me that thought there was no way it was going to happen. So I was so excited and on the verge of, you know, actually pulling the whole thing off.
And unfortunately, some very ill-timed ill health at just the wrong time conspires to ultimately make this all just beyond your reach.
It's almost like some big colossal joke, it seems like, you know, because that was the week that in which I did these miraculously fast test set times. It was also the week in which I got a staph infection, which then, because of some medicine he gave me, led to renal failure. It was MRSA staph, that antibiotic resistant staph. So that was, I had to go through like 3 or 4 surgeries because of it. And then I had renal failure because of the medication he gave me, and then anemia. And so I ended up, you know, in other words, not racing again until about 3 months later. And I was completely out of shape, I think, because I'd been in bed for 2.5 months. And I still went for it, but it didn't happen. But part of me believes that, you know, I don't really believe in fate, I don't think, or if anyone else starts setting things up. But somehow I feel like this is a good thing, and that it's better off this way, because it has me still training and trying to make the trials, you know, for 4 more years. And so, you know, if I can make it as a 49-year-old, that'd be even more, you know, amazing. seeing them making as a 45-year-old. And it'll be more proof, you know, that this is something that older people can do. So, in a way, again, I see this as like a little bit of a blessing that I didn't make it.
W.H. Hodding Carter.